the Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a Grade Cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Grade Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast for possibly the final podcast of the summer. Of course, we will look forward to the South Africa series and with an eye on returning. But in the meantime, we'll be covering the last of the cricketing embers of this summer, the BBL. Lloyd Pope took 8 wickets in an under-19s World Cup competition today. Who the fuck is Lloyd Pope? We're going to be talking about that. Obviously, the South African squad has been announced. Sorry, the Australian squad to tour South Africa has been announced. And England have won the ODIs 3-0 in another dull, meaningless series. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined, as ever, by two of my favourite people to speak to on this podcast. Sam Perry and Dave Edwards join us for one last time. Going around again one last time this summer. Hello, boys. Welcome.
Hi, Ian. Oh, yeah, I thought when you were saying two most favourite people that Mike Atherton was joining on one of those secret freeways that we used to do. Now, let me just explain that three-way phone call. When you're a teenager, you know, people would hide on the three-way call. Yeah. Anyway, stop saying three-way, Pezza. Thanks for the intro. He goes, cricket's taken like a bit of a back seat, hasn't it? Is there an Ashes hangover? Is that explaining our ODI slump? Probably not. It's strange over here. I mean, even so, people still want to talk to me in London about the ODI stuff. People suggested to me at work that Australia needs to start focusing on the modern game a little bit more, that it was too stuck in the past with its test match success. Obviously all tongue-in-cheek, but even still, I get upset by it.
Yeah, I'm finding it hard, boys, and it's great to be with you for potentially the last podcast of the series. It's good how we keep our windows open at all times. Never commit to anything. Caveat everything. The one day is I've struggled to get into it because you've got T20s going on and we've just come off the test series. It's a forgotten format, and it's always quite jarring to turn on and brace yourself for 6 to 8 hours of back-to-back cricket and slow run scoring. The game the other day, Australia failing in a run chase, having elected to bowl first. It's just disappointing and depressing, and I can't handle it because I've just having an Ashes hangover, just come off that. Can't deal with this loss. Can't deal with these fucking losses.
So, only sing when you're winning, as Robbie Williams once said. Actually, that was swing when you're winning. Anyway, so I mean, I think generally speaking. Cricket is definitely on the back burner, and if it wasn't for two of our massive guests that we've somehow managed to land, well, I say somehow, Pez has organised this, but Mitchell Marsh and George Bailey are on the show, and you know, you don't need to know that because you've seen the names on attached to this podcast. Yeah. But still, if it wasn't for those two names, would anyone listen to this podcast? I think my whole entire point here that I'm trying to make slowly here, chaps, is that because the Ashes, I think it was such a letdown of a series. Obviously Australia played very well, England played well in parts, but you know, 4-0, it was over midway through Perth. And then since then, you know, we've been kind of, well, what's the next thing? What's the thing that's going to make us happy the most? And I suppose we'll start with the ODIs. It is 3-0, so we haven't even been given a good ODI series. England have played extremely well. They're a very good team. Australia have put together strong teams, but not our strongest side. But 3-0 again. Now we've got two more dead rubbers. So basically there's been, so far of the 8 games that have been played between Australia and England across two different formats this summer, there's going to be 4 of those are going to be dead rubbers. So I think that contributes to all of our malaise into what's actually happening with the cricket sphere.
England is so good, he goes, in ODI cricket. Like, you look at the Australian side and they sort of look comprehensive across the park. They have blistering openers. They have huge rig-based selections in the middle order. You know, everyone likes Zampa. We've still got a fast bowling cartel. So you're like, oh, everything, you know, Steve Smith's in the side. So, like, where's the weakness? But then we just sort of suck compared to England in all facets. They're sort of light years ahead at the moment. There's a World Cup here in 18 months' time. We better get our shit together because I only live for winning.
So Dave, I want to put this to you because I was watching the third ODI the other night, and Australia were in a run chase. They were chasing 270 odd, and there was something about it which was so much more appealing than the Big Bash, for instance, or like a T20, and that there was still hope. There was hope that, and it dragged on for a long period of time, that Australia could get their shit together. Then Steve Smith got caught with a very controversial caught behind the wicket by Joss Butler. But it was just like this elongated hope that Australia could win the match. Whereas in Big Bash, basically, if you have one bat over, then it's done. Then you still have to play out the remaining 10 overs. Whereas like it was the hope that got me in Eddowes. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's probably why it is the perfect format for television, isn't it? Because it's never really over until it's over. I mean, a Big Bash game, you're right. You can turn it on and a team can be 3-1 for the first over and you might as well just fucking pack your bags and go home because you've wasted $30. Or if you're actually watching it, you're probably paying $60 a month to watch Foxtel. Although it's not on Foxtel, is it? Fuck, I've got my wires crossed today. But, where am I going with this? All I'm saying, he goes, is that one day cricket is fucked. And I'm suffering from this existential malaise that you speak of. Can we talk about something else? Well, can we get onto the tests? Let's get onto the fucking tests. Yeah, something that means something.
Okay. Well, we'll save Dave here and we'll move on. So the Australian squad to tour South Africa has been announced. No real surprises. And I would include the omission of Chad Sayes in that, even though that's probably the biggest talking point. I mean, that's my point of view. Has anyone got any thoughts on Chad Sayes' omission from the squad? Sam Perry, I'm looking at you. Perhaps even Dave wants this one.
Do I? Okay, I'll take it. He goes, look, I think it was always going to happen, wasn't it? I mean, Sayers, he's the perennial whipping boy. He's been left out of so many tours. He's taken so many wickets over the past 6-7 years. Mm. And along comes this young bloke, Jai Richardson. He's got an interesting salad. He's played 5 games of first-class cricket. Mm. But he can allegedly bowl 140 k's an hour in short bursts. So that will always obviously win over the reliable, proven performer, who's been taking bags of wickets successfully at the level directly below Test cricket for 7 years and counting. I just think it's just weird, this era that we live in. I think it is related to the era that we're in, because back in the 90s, it was a different era. You know, coming off the back of the 70s, the era of Thompson and Lilly, you know, hyper-hetero aesthetics and all. But the 90s was a peaceful era. You know, the Cold War had ended. European Union was ratified, and in this newfound calm, we developed an appreciation for things other than pace bowling. We appreciated subtlety and artistry in seam bowling, and you'll probably remember Adam Dale opening the bowling in the 90s. You know, bowling less than 120 k's and taking 1-20 off 10 reliably, because selectors saw the value here. They looked past his lack of levers, is what I'm saying, and they put value in his line and length and his ability to take wickets. These days, Glenn McGrath would be brushed off as just meds. It's fucking out of control the way that we have an obsession with pace, and it does look as if they've looked at Sayers' lack of pace, which is ironic because Wernher Philander probably bowls around the same speed and does about the same amount with the ball. And is very successful on South African soil. So I just don't really understand where we are here and our relationship with speed and fast and alpha. And I can only put it down to the global era that we're in, the unstable era where it's all zero sum and fucking pace means everything.
Mm. I blame China as well.
Dave, you'd have Sayers in the 11?
Well, I just think that if you bowl less than 135 kilometres an hour these days, it doesn't matter who you are, you'll just be just meds. And it's hard to overcome that. Like, what does Sayers do now? Like, you know, aside from fucking quitting cricket and turning off his phone and leaving the game and going back to uni and getting a degree and moving on with his life, like, what does he do? He probably has to find 10 k's an hour somewhere. I don't know. Does he fucking start chucking it? It's probably his only option.
So Pez, I'll work you into this one, but, like, I think what's the most interesting thing about this, not his non-selection, the fact that he didn't get a phone call to say that he wasn't selected, which to me says how far away he actually is from the reckoning of actually playing a test match, right? I mean, would you agree with that, the fact that he didn't get a phone call to say that you're not touring?
There seems to be this, like, proliferation of stories coming out now about, like, the way people were dropped, and the common theme seems to be a lack of communication in Australian cricket. But, like, I guess my question is, if it's always been thus, that you don't get spoken to, then what's the problem? What's different? Brett Jeeves came out with an article today saying that there's this sort of time-honoured secret tradition, not secret anymore, I suppose, where Steve Waugh sends a text to you if you're going to play for Australia. It's not clear in his article about whether that's a text if you make the squad or the 11, but he tells the story that Sayers last year got this text before the Adelaide test in 2016, so 2 years ago. But Jackson Bird ended up getting the start in the 11. So he was that close, and no one knows what happened in this intervening 24 hours between War's text and Sayers' omission. I just want to say on the Sayers thing, the spicy element to it is this kind of dog whistle when you read sort of South Australian or Victorian press that this is really like a New South Wales and now WA conspiracy. There seems to be these pockets of power in Australian cricket whereby if you play for New South Wales, then obviously you get the baggy green with that. But now it seems to be happening in WA as well, where Justin Langer's influence is kind of growing, and you see these WA people start to make their way in the side. And Jai Richardson is obviously a sand groper, as they say. So the question I'm saying is, you know, is there an anti-South Australian bias, and how good a thing is that?
So, we've spoken to enough cricketers, you know, like professional cricketers now, not just like blokes that we used to play against, because we obviously don't talk to them anymore. But like, the word around the circuit of Shield cricket is that Chad Sayers is exceptional at Adelaide Oval, but Jackson Bird, for instance, is the better bowler. And I think statistics might even show that, especially when he's at the beginning of this season, he's performed very well, Jackson Bird. So, like, I mean, that seems to be the chat. So, I mean, Jackson Bird doesn't bowl 140s yet. He was picked, you know, for Melbourne, so obviously on a shocking wicket. But what are our thoughts on that, Pez?
It's going to be pretty close, isn't it? Like, I mean, I just want to say that the Australian selectors have publicly opted for a horses for courses policy a couple of years ago, and it's actually bearing fruit. And let's be honest, I mean, Australia versus South Africa in South Africa is the ultimate alpha showdown.
Yep.
I know we talk about alpha all the time and it's becoming tedious, but like, everybody is big. I feel like, you know, everyone's vegan, but everyone, I just feel like everyone sits there at tea eating masses of meat. Everyone's got chests. It's a bench press off. And really, I feel like Australia just need to take big people to South Africa, because everything is just boisterous and robust and bounces, and wickets are bouncy. It's just like, it's like going into a parallel Australian universe. All the kind of the backdrops for TV are of huge mountains and stuff,
it's
as well.
Scary.
So,
everyone is massive.
This is what
mate.
The thinking was. Sayers bowls under 140 and he's under 180 centimetres.
So, yeah, well, maybe it's the 180 centimetres thing that is the biggest issue. It's all about taking your biggest squad to South Africa. I remember when I went to South Africa, actually on a school cricket tour as a 15-year-old and playing alongside 18-year-old teammates. It was a real eye-opener because I was small. I was yet to, well, I never did, grow into levers and biceps. So I was confronted there with my own first taste of men's cricket. So you really are coming up. They're just big over there. They say braai instead of barbecues. Like, it's fucking weird and it's hard to get used to. But hopefully we just, you know, win one or two tests.
Well, one art that appears to not be dead in this country, and that's just because of one bloke in the Under-19 World Cup taking 8 for today against the old enemy, England. Lloyd Pope took 8 for 35, I think, in 9.4 overs to defend Australia's score of a meagre 127, and he rolled England out himself pretty much for 94, 95, 96, 97, something like that, with a proliferary of wrong-ins and some wonderful catching by Jason Sanger at first, the captain of Australia's Under-19 World Cup. I don't know if either of you guys saw this, but it was actually a seriously impressive display of leg spin bowling from Lloyd Pope, who's got one of the worst salads you'll ever see. And I guarantee it right now that he will be sans hair by the time he's 25.
Ian Higgins, National 9 News.
Why do you think that, Higgins? Are you talking about like an elective shaving of the head, or is he losing his salary?
No.
He's one of those guys who have like really long hair now, but you can see it's like it's very thin hair.
You're always quick to identify those people, aren't you? You're always really quick to identify.
Our expert is...
It's a high forehead. It's a high forehead and it's thin hair. Forehead. And those two factors together spell trouble for Lloyd. And the fact that his hair is long would suggest that he's aware of that too. It's a coverage issue. Lloyd, the shorter the hair is, the thicker it will look, but you'll have to discover that yourself.
It just reminded me of like what I said about Tom Curran earlier in the year. Like the haircut just didn't suit his style of hair. Anyway, that aside, so Kirio Keith got on Twitter today and he said this bloke is good, and now people are comparing him to Shane Warne because, you know, if you bowl leg spin, you put one good performance in, you're going to take 704 Test wickets. So Lloyd Pope, next Shane Warne.
Oh, absolutely, quite clearly. I was on. Yeah, I went to bed early last night, but I noticed the England press Twitterati talking about how great it was that Australia was, you know, 27-4 in the cricket, and I say it that way around deliberately. And I did have the thought Australia's going to win this. I don't know why, because we're losing all of the games in coloured clothing anyway. But it was great to wake up to a leg spinner decimating a side defending 120 odd. That doesn't seem to happen these days when you think about how good the pitches are and bats and all that sort of malarkey. For someone just to, and also I think the bowlers around him didn't seem to do particularly well either. I know another opening bowler went for 17 off two overs, and you know, good friend of the show or son of a good friend of the show, Will Sutherland, you know, didn't have much success with the ball either. But it's great. It's really good to see. And I think from memory, Lloyd Pope might have caused some damage to the England side in a CA 11 match before the season started as well, in one of these sort of much criticised warm-up games. He ended up impressing guys like Kerry O'Keefe and other people in the leg spin community more than Mason Crane. So good luck to him.
Yeah, no, I just noticed on Twitter now that Tom Morris, our Fox Sports colleague, has written an article on the backstory to Australia's newest cult hero. So you know someone's on the up when Tom Morris is writing a feature article on him. I say that earnestly.
Lads, I don't know if how much interest there is even from this podcast about, you know, the Big Bash League, but there was a proper remarkable catch overnight. Melbourne Renegades, DJ Bravo bombed the ball to the offside field, and two Adelaide Strikers players combined for just a phenomenal catch. I mean, like, anybody who's got the internet right now should just look that up. They've probably already seen it, but it was amazing. But the Big Bash League, I mean, like, it's getting now to the semi-final stage. Adelaide have got a home semi. Perth will also have a home semi. And that new stadium that they've got over there, I think it's called Optus Stadium, of course it is. How much interest have you guys got to watch the finals, the knockout stages of the Big Bash?
No, I've not engaged with it this summer or winter over here, really. Here goes. Like, it's served a decent enough purpose of being on in the background and seeing the odd good play here and there, as you described, and that was a wonderful play. But, I don't really know much about what's going on with the teams. I don't know if I said this last week. It'd be kind of ironic if I did, but it does feel like TV repeats. The Big Bash, it just feels like we've sort of seen this show before, and I just wonder if it needs a regeneration of names. It needs new characters. It just feels a little tired, you know, from my standpoint.
I feel like it just goes a little too long as well, and I think they're even talking about expanding it next season or maybe the season afterwards, but fuck me, I'm burned out by it, and I haven't been watching it every night, but it is on every night. It's fucking in your face every night. it sounds weird, but it's frightening. It's just oversaturation, I think. I think they've got a great product and now they're just milking the absolute fuck out of it, which is good for them because commercially they'll make lots of monies.
I think the country as a whole just seems to be suffering this burnout of cricket, and I blame the Ashes for that. I think there was like such a build up. Yeah, the Ashes this year, it's going to be huge, Big Bash, you know, but it's just everything feels a little bit jaded. I think people are a little bit
so
fatigued.
Tired, he goes. Really, really tired.
And obviously, us being the leading voice of Australian cricketers across the country, we have in no way contributed to this malaise.
Other than to remark on it every week.
It is tired. Fucking exhausting.
All right, we've got two huge guests this week just for you guys, and also for the three of us. So we're going to hear from Mitchell Marsh and George Bailey, so stick around.
And Dave Edwards and Ian Higgins, along with Sam Perry, are the authors of Tea and No Sympathy, the second of the Grade Cricketer novels. Dave, this novel starts, and I'm not giving too much away here because it is at the start, it starts with dirty doings in C grade. the grade cricketer gets involved in fixing a match, although in a kind of going along with it more sort of beta male kind of way.
I mean, one of the key characters in the book is his name is Nugsy, and then we find out his backstory.
They've all got these appalling nicknames.
Oh, Nugsy, Rooster, Chooker, a lot of poultry-based nicknames in grey cricket. Ooh. But Nugsy, for example, he's the archetypal jock cricketer who, you know, wears a wife beater. He drinks far too much. He has a horrible gambling problem. Ooh. But he's also in the book. We find out about his backstory, and it's very incongruous that he actually comes from, you know, French parentage. And has spent a lot of his time and youth growing up in the south of France.
Speaks fluent French.
I feel like a lot of people ask us, like, are these characters based on anyone? And, like, I think Nugsy especially is, like, he's not based on any one person in particular that we know, but he's, like, the worst traits of everyone we know all into one character.
An amalgam.
He goes, it's a distinct pleasure to have this next cricket writer, journalist on. It's his debut on the show. I've been trying to get him on for a long time, but he's a tough man to pin down. I'm talking about Vidushan Hantharaja. He writes for everybody over here in the UK, for The Guardian, for Crick Info. He does great articles for Cricket Monthly. You can hear him on BBC commentary doing the county stuff. At the moment, though, he's closer to you than me because he's in Australia covering the England ODI stuff. I think he's going to New Zealand doing stuff for The Guardian, The Evening Standard and Wisden. He's a man about town and he's also one of the best follows on Twitter there is. I'm going to revert to Vish, though, for your name. Vish, welcome to The Grey Cricketer. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I don't know if you saw, but as soon as you announced on Twitter that I'd be on, the first two replies were friends of mine saying that I finally made it. So if my body of work over the last 5 years hadn't done it, then this sole appearance now is reason enough to be alive, I'd say.
How embarrassing. You've definitely not made it. This is a hodgepodge arrangement where the internet barely works. But nevertheless, you know, if it's, you know, perception is reality, Vish. Can you, speaking of perception is reality, the perception over here is that England are a fantastic ODI side, that Australia need to concentrate more on the modern game and stop being rooted in history. Tell us your impressions of watching England win all the time in the ODI cricket.
I'm not going to lie, it's a very, very weird sensation. There was a moment when Steve Smith was asked if Australia need to adopt England's approach to one-day cricket, and without skipping a beat, he said yes. Now, you know, everyone's familiar with how England love to tell the rest of the world how to do things around cricket, and the very last thing I thought was that we'd be in an ODI series where an Australian captain would be like, you know what, they're doing something right there. They're doing something right in ODI cricket because, God, yeah, for the longest time it's been so, so grim. I can't really tell you how it's happened. Basically, all I can equate it to is that someone somewhere in one of the ECB's many labs just looked up and thought, what happens if we just went out there and chinned the fucker? Because that's basically what they're doing.
Isn't it, mate? Because, like, you guys just go out there and just pump it from the start. It's just at all times you're hitting over 300 runs. And, you know, we were saying earlier on the show that Australia seemed to have this well-rounded side with Smith and blistering openers and a good middle order and fast bowlers and Zampa's okay, but it's not enough. We're just rungs below you guys.
Yeah, it's strange, though, because, I'm not saying that the way England are doing it is a blueprint that everyone else should adopt, because evidently it hasn't really worked for them. They lost the final of the World T20 in 2016. They lost in the semi-finals of the Champions Trophy last year. But if Australia were to try and mimic what England do, then you've got all the players for it. You know, Smith can do that Joe Root role brilliantly. You've got Warner and Finch as well. And then you've got the likes of Marsh. You've got Stoinis, who, by the way, I mean, you know, Liam Plunkett over here is fighting the rig battle for England, but Marcus Stoinis is bringing the heat. He is something else. but you have these players who are clear. I mean, you know, even in the having followed the BBL over here since coming over here, Darcy Shaw, Alex Carey, these are players who are taking the game to the next level in terms of being able to, I suppose, just go big from the off. And, you know, there isn't really that much tweaking that needs to be done to get them in and get Australia playing, quote-unquote, a modern brand of ODI cricket. Sorry, that was very ECV, but hopefully that's the last of those.
Modern brands.
Fish, I want to ask you, like, I don't think the Australian public, which are obviously the most informed, you know, cricket spectators in the world, they saw this coming. I don't think that I thought that the series would be close because I respected the English team. They bat deep. I mean, Wokes hit a 50 the other night, just whacked him, and he's batting, what, 9? I didn't see 3-0 coming, but I wonder what the English public and the English team, more importantly, I suppose, did you guys see, you know, 3-0 coming out here?
I didn't think England would do what they did, what they've done in previous one-day series, or follow like such a traumatic Ashes and fall completely. Partly because they had quite a few players coming in who had no experience of that, and crucially their captain Owen Morgan. I don't think he's seen a red ball for the last 4 years, so
yeah.
You know, I don't think he knows that people are still playing Test cricket. But what he can do is come in and, I suppose, inject a bit of energy and have some new ideas as well. Joe Root said the other day that he felt Owen Morgan was, he was learning stuff from Owen Morgan and he could continue to learn stuff from Owen Morgan. Mark Wood said today that Owen Morgan's the best captain he's played under. Now, you know, obviously it's all quite easy to say nice things when you're doing well, but I think there's a lot of sincerity in those words. I think Morgan in particular has been quite a big driver of this because he's quite ruthless. He's a little bit of a bastard, but in a good way. I suppose, can I say an Australian way on this podcast? but there's something about him that really that kind of exudes calm. And you know, if he I'm currently looking out my window now and I'm about 6 floors up, and if he told me to jump off I probably would, and I'd probably do it in an attacking manner.
I mean, what's the impact of Trevor Bayliss there? Because I mean, like the sort of alpha aggression that is associated with England's bowling and batting. Stop laughing at the word alpha, Mish. you know, it seems really Australian in a lot of ways. Like, I'm trying to gain some sort of moral victory here for some reason on this podcast. I have no idea why. But, like, the way that, you know, Josh Butler sort of batted the other night, just, like, it's incredible. Front foot dog just whacking it over bowlers' heads. Like, I mean, what's the impact that Trevor Bayliss has had on the white ball game in the UK?
On the white ball game in the UK, it can't be said that he's anything other than a success. Even if England don't go and win the World Cup next year, which, looking at things and looking at the investment, you'd say would be a tragedy in so many ways. And it feels weird saying that about World Cup when England have only dealt in tragedies. Mm. But with Bayliss in particular, I think it's just people, for so long, England have had very, very good 50-over cricketers and some very good 20-over cricketers as well. But because of the... I'm trying to find the right word here, and all I can think of is because of the arsiness at the very top of the English game, they've kind of been made to feel like they're second-class citizens in so many ways. You know, people would post big scores in domestic white ball cricket and they wouldn't really get picked. It would just be the ODI side was an extension of the Test side and that kind of filtered down into the T20 side as well. And now I think Bayliss is, you know, he doesn't have a great knowledge of county cricket, but from the players he's seen, he certainly remembers fondly players like, you know, Mason. Mason Crane basically got a Test cap because Bayliss saw him get out AB de Villiers. It doesn't matter that it was a slog swept six. Potentially was caught right on the boundary's edge. He's seen Mason Crane do something that he thought was impressive in the white ball game and has given him a test berth. Now, you only need to see how successful that's been because the last I checked, we don't have the Ashes anymore. Could be wrong there. it's all white ball cricket here. You know, I don't really follow tests anymore. But yeah, you know, so... So, yeah, obviously, at Test cricket, he can go a lot better, and he has to take some responsibility for that. But in terms of white ball cricket, he's been quite a liberating presence and kind of been a breath of fresh air. There'll be English fans to tell you that they don't give a shit, but, you know, I'm sure they will come next year.
Vish, there's been reports and there's been a lot of footage over here and at home in Australia about Steve Smith possibly putting lip balm on the ball. I don't even know when to say allegedly or not these days. The listeners know that. And it reminded me of a great piece you did in the Cricket Monthly magazine I think it was last year, where you spoke about some of the things that players do. You spoke to a lot of players, especially on the condition of anonymity, about the things that they do or have done in the past to alter the ball. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned from talking to players about that and also where people can find that piece? Because I think it was very interesting.
Yeah, cheers. So, yeah, that was a piece for Cricket Monthly. And the one thing that I garnered from him speaking to us with English players and some international players as well is that everyone's a bunch of cheats. Everyone is at it. You know? I suppose, you know, there are varying degrees of it. So there's one great story I heard, and it was a representative game played in the north of England in May. I think it was against the touring West Indies. It was, I want to say, about 7 or 8 years ago, of a player who basically every summer sharpens one of his fingernails and uses it throughout the season as, let's say, a way of kind of scratching the ball, let's say. And, well, I mean, that's exactly what it is. Scratching the ball. And he tops it, you know, he preserves that nail through the season with nail hardener and stuff like that. And for this game, it was a bit of a nothing game. And he managed to get the ball reversing after 10 overs.
I mean, we talk a lot about the kind of futility and the boredom of going from square leg to cover in cricket, but maybe this is a lateral thinking way to remain involved in the game, just to develop a claw every summer, as this player seems to have done.
Yeah, that's the thing. Whenever you see a team and they've got some Wolverine looking bloke in a number 8 thing, he doesn't bat or bowl, then you know, yeah, keep your eye on the ball between that kind of 30 and 60 over phase. Yeah, it was fascinating, really. I mean, I was quite churlish when I say everyone cheats. I think people have tried to find ways of doing it differently, you know. Obviously the story of Marcus Trescothick during the 2005 Ashes with those Murray mints, that was something that was passed on to him by Dermot Reeve and his Warwickshire side of the 90s. Asif Din used to have these sweets and used to show the ball and get really, really thick lacquer going on one side. You hear all sorts of stories. One of my favourite stories is actually from grade cricket about how people used to take a rag out covered in glue and they basically let the glue harden and then use that to, when they dry their hands, to also, you know, work on the ball. So, you know, you're a bigger bunch of cheats as we are.
Didn't even say anything.
Well, Vish, to that end, I was reminded just as you're talking about then about, I mean, my second grade captain for a number of years, he actually used to put the ball overnight in the freezer in the thought that it would make it harder, and it did absolutely nothing, and we chased 400 a lot that year. So, you know, does anybody know how the ball swings? I still don't think anyone knows how it actually swings.
Yeah, I think the point is that you played second grade. That's the point of that story, isn't it? Alfred. Vish, thanks so much for joining us. This is it's been great to have you on for the season finale. Finally, we've had you on and people can hear your excellent insights, and you can read Vish anywhere. He's all over the shop. Mate, enjoy the rest of your time in Australia and New Zealand.
Cheers, boys. Thanks for having me.
This is the story of all those Saturday afternoons you said to yourself, why? This is the story of when it's all you've ever known and you have a deep-seated fear of change. This is the story of what happens when you used to be good. This is the story that began in 1882 and finished with your father still not turning up to watch you play. This is the story of unemployed middle-aged men who sledge 15-year-olds and give send-offs to players that are younger and already better than them. Of part-time uni students trying to make it back into second grade. Of men who turn up the training in suits just to appear intelligent. Of men who lie to their wives when the game is called off. Of blokes who bat 8 and don't bowl. Of the all-time circuits that are paid for by club presidents with offshore bank accounts and mail-order brides. This is the story of the endless pursuit of the Triple C, the century, the circuit, the chop. This is the story of Nugsy, of Bruiser, of Chooker, of Nathan, of Robbo. This is the story of Dad. This is the story of what to do when the game's just not that into you. This is the story of change, of fitting in again, of finding yourself. This is the story of Lara. This is for every partner who doesn't understand the LBW rule. This is for everyone who's ever asked, who's winning? This is the gift guide for that nephew that you haven't spoken to in 12 months, and you heard he likes cricket. He won't soon. This is the story of a father-son match, a poker match, a Tinder match, A match that finally broke me. This is the story of a circuit, a chop king, of incongruous French history, of Nugsy's car, of our darkest day as best friends. This is the story of reconciliation, of popped collars, of Mark Waugh's cover drive, of what it's like to lose the only thing you've ever loved. This is the story of my life. Your life. Of every lifeless wicket on a Saturday afternoon. This is The Grade Cricketer. Tea and no sympathy.
Boys, a distinct pleasure to welcome this next guy onto the show. Some background, as always. He debuted for WA at 17. He debuted for Australia at 19. He's got hundreds and fifers in both tests and ODIs. He's hit 200s in his last four digs for Australia. He's an Ashes victor. And most importantly, his nickname is Bison. Honestly, that is the greatest achievement, I think, of all of this. All cricketers would know that. I'm, of course, talking about Mitchell Marsh. Mitch Marsh. Mitch, welcome to The Grade Cricketer.
Mate, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You're in Perth, I'm in London, the other two boys are in Sydney. We'll see how the phone line holds up here. We always start the same way, Mitch, by asking for, you know, what your relationship is to grade cricket. And I suppose my question is, do you even know what grade cricket is, given that you debuted for Australia at 19?
Lad, I'll talk you through my last grade game for the mighty Port Fremantle boys. In between a couple of Shield games, first week, it was 45 degrees. We lost the toss and bowled. Sort of first slip for the day. Dropped two catches. Came back next week. Beautiful batting conditions. Got a second ball duck. So I've really hit my straps in great cricket this year.
How did you not just retire from cricket after that? I'm very surprised you didn't just automatically retire.
Yeah, our grade ground's got one of the longest walk-offs in the history of great cricket too, so I had a lot of dark thoughts as I was walking off the ground there, but I do love playing for the Port. They're a great club, and love getting back there.
So Mitch, you must have just been playing sport. Like, sport must just be in the household non-stop. Obviously Sean hits them pretty well as well, and you're obviously playing for Australia these days. And then your sister, Lisa as well, played 14 seasons in the WNBL. As a kid in the household growing up, were you guys just sport non-stop?
We certainly were, yeah. I think Sean and Melissa, having grown up on a farm, they spent a lot of time outdoors in their younger years, and then once we moved to Perth, Dad didn't want to live on a small block, so we lived just out of Perth on 2.5 acres, and we were lucky enough as kids to grow up with a tennis court, and which had a basketball ring, which also proved to be the centre stage for our backyard cricket battles as well. So, you know, as a family and as kids, we spent so much time outdoors just playing all sorts of sport that I think that's where our love for sport stemmed from.
And when you were a young kid, Mitch, your dad was the coach of the Australian cricket team, and in the late 90s, no less, the best era in the history of sport, regardless of the code, really. Do you realise, firstly, how lucky you are? and just secondly, what it was like being a young kid, you know, 7, 8 years old, and having your dad coaching the national team? Because I'm guessing you got kind of inside that inner sanctum and you would have met a couple of the greats, but just having your dad there coaching the Australian cricket team and you kind of being around that, what was that like?
Yeah, it was phenomenal, really. When you think about it now, as a kid, I probably took it for granted because I just thought it was normal. But, you know, now...
Yeah, it's really normal.
I realise how... lucky I was to be, you know, to share a change room as a young kid. You know, with Steve Waugh and Gilchrist and Warne and McGrath, all those guys. I remember sitting on a bus in England one day. I was sitting next to Shane Warne and he just handed me this massive wad of cash. he was obviously taking the piss out of me, and I went up to Dad. Dad pretty much yelled at me on the bus to give that back right now. So that sort of stuff I didn't know what was going on. But, you know, I was very lucky to have those guys around me.
Have you ever thought about returning the favour to Warnie next time you see him, just like handing him just wads of cash?
Yeah, I'm not sure my wads of cash are the same or as big as Warnie's wads of cash. But,
Mitch, obviously it's been an excellent last couple of weeks for you for a number of reasons. Can you just sort of take us into, you know, how you guys are feeling after winning the Ashes, and also just personally for you with the, I guess, you know, extraordinary comeback and the way you performed in the last couple of tests as well. You know, how have the celebrations been? I mean, for example, there was a text message floating around that I saw that, you know, saw you in a pub with a guitar. I don't know if you, I mean, if you were just serenading people there or whatever. If you could just take us through all of that, that'd be great.
Yeah, look, it was a, you know, a good month. I really hit my straps after that last test, though. So, yeah, that was for us. Oh, look, it was, yeah, like we obviously celebrated in person when we won the Ashes, but we had the you know, the carrot dangling for us to go 5-0, and it obviously wasn't meant to be, but it was really nice to finish off the way we did and finish 4-0. And, you know, we certainly were given a license to celebrate, because it's not every day you win Ashes Series 4-0. So we celebrated that night, and as we saw in a few of the, I think it was Daily Telegraph, one of the all-time worst articles, we celebrated into the next day, and it was fantastic to be able to reflect on that. I wasn't too well the next morning, but it's a great 24 hours.
So, Mitch, I'm just looking at them, you know, just sort of looking back now on the 3-1 days that have been. It must have been extraordinarily difficult to put so much effort and energy into that Ashes series, you know, come away 4-0 victors. I mean, how hard is it to turn that around so quickly to then get your mind right for one day international straight away?
It was tough. I think we had 5 or 6 days, so we certainly enjoyed ourselves after the test match, but once we came into the one-day camp, you know, there was no talk of us being flat or anything. We prepared as well as we could have. You know, everyone could say there's an element of us coming off the Ashes and being a bit flat, but it certainly hasn't felt like that. And England have just outplayed us, really, in the last 3 games. So it's been really disappointing to lose the one-day series, but we've obviously still got 2 games to go, and we're playing for a lot of pride now.
Mm. Yeah, over here in London, Mitch, there's a lot of people at work who are much more keen to talk to me about the cricket after the one days than they were for the test matches at any stage, which is just remarkable. I just wanted to speak a bit about you, and I've got like a bit of a personal observation here. Like, all-rounders seem to get it the worst in Australia because, you know, we just have this thing where in Australia we just want everything all the time. You know, we need all-rounders to hit hundreds, to bat quickly, mm-hmm. to look, you know, mm-hmm. alpha at all times, you know, to bowl 140s, to take wickets, take catches, all against the best players in the world. You know, there's no quarter given, and if you're not doing that, you tend to cop it a lot. You know, you've spoken before about social media vitriol that you've received in the last couple of years. Can you just give us an insight into what it's like, you know, to cop that kind of stuff, and what it was like during that period?
Yeah, it was obviously pretty tough. I think probably the hardest part about it, well, if you learn to not take stuff personally, then it's fine. But I think when I was going through that period, I was pretty much, I got off Twitter, which was the best thing I've ever done. But I was also
reading
every Facebook comment and quotes coming up on the Instagram photos. And I sort of took all of those personally, and you know, I probably got to a stage where I was walking out to bat during test matches and thinking about those sorts of things. And trying to prove people wrong instead of actually just watching the ball and playing the game of cricket and enjoying it for what it is. So, you know, I've certainly learned over the last 18 months that you can't worry about that. And, you know, I've sort of got to the stage now where I really don't care, apart from people that I care about and people that are close to me. It doesn't really matter what other people say. And I've sort of proven to myself that I can actually go out there and play at test level, which has been great. So hopefully I'll be able to keep going now.
Yeah, and Mitch, you've chosen to skip the IPL coming up in favour of honing your game in county cricket in England. Firstly, you obviously hate money. seriously, what my actual question is that it's a very big decision to forego that kind of financial windfall. I'm just wondering what drove that decision, and was it your decision alone, or was it one that you made following a talk with some other influential figures?
Yeah, I certainly spoke to obviously my dad and Justin Langer, and I spoke to Cook as well. I basically made the decision before this season started, having really thought that I wasn't going to play any part for Australia. I thought I was going to play the one days if I was in good form, but I really didn't think that I was going to play any part for Australia in the longer format. And I think I'm probably, you never know in an auction, but I have turned down a fair chunk of money. I made that decision with the best interest to play Test Match Cricket for Australia. And at the end of the day, if you're playing Test Match Cricket for Australia, then, you know, the money side of things takes care of itself. And it doesn't exactly drive me to walk out there and perform to earn good money. It's the fact that I want to play cricket for Australia for as long as I can, and then the rest takes care of itself. So it was a big decision. And I think, if I was probably 30 years of age and, you know, getting to that stage of my career, there's no way I'd be turning down the IPL. But I've still got an opportunity to work on my game as much as I can the next 12 months, and then go from there. And hopefully I'll still have a good, 8 years of IPL after this one. And, probably never get that money back, but hopefully I can.
Maybe Warnie will give it to you in a paper bag.
So much wads of cash and paper bag talk in this conversation. I know it's all been really earnest so far, Mitch. I just, if I could continue that theme a little bit, it's quite obvious that there's a maturation process going on with you. You know, you're talking about a change from not thinking about Facebook comments when you go out to bat for Australia to proving yourself on that stage and choosing Surrey over the IPL. You've spoken a little bit recently about the changes to your actual batting, you know, and the things that you've done to, I guess, evolve in that sphere of your cricket. And you spoke about your coach, Scott Mulliman, and, you know, how you've kind of learnt the importance of defence. I'd love to get to Australia and only then discover the importance of defence. But and I think previously you sort of had spoken about maybe being just a bit of a front dog player. Also, I would love to be that too. But can you just take us into that thought process a little bit? I mean, what changes have you made to your batting?
Yeah, look, Scotty got a hold of me after my pretty much when I came home from India. I've known Scott for a long time. He lived with Sean when they were younger, back in the heyday. And obviously, Bob's coached so many great cricketers in Western Australia. So I thought that something had to change my game. And I pretty much went to Scotty and asked him to have a few hits. I was pretty lost, really, when I came home from India. I didn't really know what to do with my batting. I didn't know what I had to change. It may sound pretty stupid from someone who's been playing for Australia, but I didn't have an answer on how to just keep working. And I'd hit thousands of balls last summer, and it just wasn't working for me. And I'm really thankful that I went and worked with Scotty. We worked on, like you said, tightening up my defence. Done a lot of work on moving my feet and getting off that front dog. that sort of stemmed from playing a lot of white ball cricket. Where, you know, that allows you to just get on the front dog and play with a lot of freedom. But for me in red ball cricket, and especially playing at my home ground being a whacker, learning to defend and lead balls and play the cut shot off the back foot has become a really important shot for me. And it's been really pleasing for me this season to be able to see that come to fruition from all the hard work in the off-season. So, I'm really thankful for Scotty. I just had about an hour and a half hit with him down at the shop. About 35 degrees here today, so I'm absolutely sweating my guts out. But I'm really thankful that he's sort of come into my cricketing life.
So, as always, Mitch, it's always the next series. We're always looking towards the horizon, and South Africa is but weeks away, really. And obviously, the squad has recently been announced. Perhaps you would be, of all people, maybe probably best qualified to talk about the inclusion of Jai Richardson. Obviously, Chad Say's exclusion has caused a bit of controversy, but perhaps you can tell us a little bit about what Jai Richardson can bring to the party in South Africa.
Yeah, look, without pumping his tyres up too much, I think he's a real talent for Australian cricket. I've watched him bowl in Shield cricket this year. He bowls genuinely fast. And for someone who's... I think a lot of times when you get someone who bowls fast and they're quite small, they can be skiddy and come onto the bat beautifully. But somehow he actually extracts a lot of bounce, which is great. And he's got the ability to swing the ball both ways when the conditions suit, which is an unbelievable skill at his pace. He's a great kid. He loves learning, loves the game. He's an absolute cricket snuff. It's actually quite funny. I was on a plane with him. We were flying out to a Shield game a couple of months ago, and he was playing this stick cricket game on his phone, and I sort of looked over, and he was just watching this stick cricket game. Said, "Oh, what are you up to?" He's like, "Oh, I'm just watching my highlights." So.
Realised
how much he loves the game, and yeah, he just loves
it,
and he's a real talent. I hope he goes well.
Wow, the subtly undercutting if I'm being an absolute cricket nuffy.
Yeah.
I hope he goes well.
That's genuine fact.
He's
watching the highlights of himself.
I didn't know that was the
thing. When was the last time he spoke to a woman?
Yeah. Me or him?
Yeah. We'll move on to the throwdown section. I think that's an appropriate segue. Mitch, we'll ask stupid questions and see what you think. If you find it funny, good. Please give us your answers, though. A simple one to start with. I read the other day, Mitch, that apparently you and your family have some rule that when you go out to bat, your grandparents who are watching aren't allowed to leave for the toilet. So when you hit 181 the other day, I presume they were pretty keen to go to the toilet. Why would you do that to elderly people?
I didn't start that rule. That was my mum. So I'm not sure how she gets to it, but she's got a bladder of steel. Mind you, the last couple of years, she hasn't had to wait long. So it's only been the last few months.
But this is kind of akin, Mitch, to that idea that you can't move when someone's batting. So when you get out, do you go up to your grandparents and say, "Who moved?"
Sorry, say that again, guys.
No, don't worry. We'll leave it. Next.
We'll keep going, Mitch. Another one on the all-rounder position, which is obviously, you know, the role historically acknowledged as the true embodiment of Australian masculinity in cricket. Keith Miller, Shane Watson, yourself, and now a new contender in Marcus Stoinis. What are you doing to stave off the threat posed by Stoinis and his irresistible rig salad combo?
Yeah, look, he's actually a phenomenal-looking man. He's pretty much got me covered in all facets of life, really, so I'm just going to have to try and run.
It just go runs, yeah.
Otherwise, I'm cooked.
So, Mitch, I'll give you the highlights of your own career, which obviously you know these things. But you captained the under 19 World Cup winning side as a junior. You've won the Ashes. You've won the World Cup at home. You've scored 100 whilst batting with your brother in a Test match. You've won the BBL. You also scored 181 not out. In an Ashes game at the WAC on your home ground. And, of course, you've also scored 102 not out in a losing side in a one-day international. So I'm just wondering why you're still playing.
I'm just reading this interview today because I've actually announced my retirement from the game.
Yes! Another exclusive on The Great Cricketer.
when you look at it like that, I've had a lot of fun along the way, so hopefully I've got a few more.
You've done it right.
Mitch, so it's well understood that you have the cricket dad that everyone wants. When your dad picked you to play for the Pune Warriors in the IPL in 2011 for $290,000, did you say thanks, Dad?
Yeah. Insider trading.
I bought him.
Definite nepotism.
Yeah.
That's for
sure.
Yeah,
that was my nickname.
Just on your dad again, Mitch, and it will frame most of the questions from here until close. You obviously experienced the euphoria in Sydney of scoring an Ashes 100 with your brother Sean, as Higos just said. So what was it like to achieve the boyhood dream of seeing dad at your games, actually watching as opposed to head down reading a newspaper?
Yeah, dad's not a great watcher, I'll tell you that. I actually got another story for you. So Sean and I, when we first batted together in Test match, was at Adelaide Oval. I'm not sure if that was the first time, but it was a pink ball test and we needed about 100 runs to win. And we had a little partnership and Dad actually left the ground. And then Paul and I started batting together and he left the ground, boys. He couldn't watch.
Did you notice that?
Because he couldn't watch or did you see him stand up and leave?
I didn't notice it, but when I heard, I gave him a spray. I said, "Man, what's the point in coming and watching if you're going to walk out the bloody ground?" Like,
All right, Mitch, let's discuss circuits. Which was the better circuit, after the World Cup win or the Ashes win, or perhaps even your 21st in South Africa?
Oh, my 21st is an absolute belter. It was worth every article. I'd have to say the World Cup, definitely. It was sort of at the end of the season, so celebrations carried on for about a month. I was best tour fan ever for the World Cup final. Celebrated like I made 100 and took 5 during the game. I was certainly close to the best on the ground. And then that whole week sort of flowed into Sean getting married as well. So it was a hell of a week.
When you wearing the Australian ODI kit out on the circuit, am I right in saying that?
Look, there's a few rumours floating about that we were in our one day kit. I think that was the skipper's orders, though. So I just feel as I'm told.
Gotcha.
Sponsors' orders.
Mitch, there's a really great shot of you and Captain Steve Smith leaving the field at the WACA after that wonderful partnership this summer, and you're both saluting the crowd in that kind of traditional way that people salute the crowds when they've made a ton. I just want to ask, why does Steve Smith hold his bat so strangely when he's saluting the crowd? He holds it by the blade, and it looks weird and incongruous, and it bothers me.
Look, there's no other way to describe it apart from the fact that he's just a strange man. he's just weird in all facets of life. Probably why he's close to the best ever, but I'm not sure why he does that, but that's just major. He's got a few things that he does differently.
You must be well and truly ensconced in the test team to just call you Captain Strange on air. But you definitely are, Mitch. I mean, just on behalf, we'll wrap it up there. Just on behalf of us and everyone who listens, congratulations on the team achievement and your personal achievements this Ashes series. You made at least Australians very proud and English people quite mad, but respectfully mad too, I would say. All the best for the ODI series, all the best for South Africa. Thanks for coming on the show.
Cheers, guys. Thanks a lot.